All right, welcome to the Leafs Plus podcast. You're here with Chris and the Six,
Michael Jabrian,
and Jay.
And we're here to talk about what's going on in Leafs Nation today. So first up on the docket, we have an idea. Who's going to be the Leafs center taking the faceoff on opening night? I personally think it's going to be Matthews because I still think it's Matthews' team. We drafted him. We did the training with him. He's been here longer than Tavares. I just see him being the de facto captain on opening night. What do you guys think?
I agree that this is Matthews' team, but I think fans are really going to want to see Tavares on opening night, and I think the Leafs are going to give him to them. And by playing Tavares first, fans are going to finally get to see what he looks like, how he's going to play, and they don't want to make the fans wait too long for that.
I think Tavares is going to take the first face against Montreal in October, and I think it's going to be Tavares' team. I don't think it's anyone's team right now. I think it's still up to debate. I think Tavares will end up becoming captain a few months down the road in this season once we look like we actually have a legitimate chance of winning the Stanley Cup. I don't think Babcock's going to wait to put Tavares out there. I think he's just going to get the nerves ended for him straight away.
Do you think Babcock would put Tavares out there as a little jab at Montreal for not even getting a meeting with Tavares in the summer?
I don't think that has anything to do with it. I think it's just, there's going to be a lot of hype and anticipation for Tavares coming from the fans and for Tavares himself. And I think he's just going to want to put that to bed and to rest as quickly as possible and get on with the season.
I mean, I think that would be pretty fun to see, just kind of jabbing it at Montreal. Just showing, like, hey, look who we got now, and you're stuck with Max Domi as your number one center.
I think that'll happen as soon as Tavares scores that first goal in that first shift.
Okay, so because we're going to be so stacked at forwards, what do you guys think about maybe doing like a 11 forward, 7D, drop that fourth line center, maybe have an extra winger, maybe someone who can play on the penalty kill or special teams as a specialist? What do you guys think there?
I think 11 forwards would be smart because now you're not having the three guys all fighting for ice time between Matthews, Tavares, and Kadri. And even though Par Lindholm could be a suitable fourth line center, I don't think he's really needed in that capacity. But also speaking of that, you don't want to have Brown just sitting on the fourth line getting 5 minutes a night because he is a usable player. You can play him on the PK, you can play him on the power play, he's fast, he's scored 20 goals in the league, so he's proven what he's capable of. And having him only playing 5 to 7 minutes a night is a waste of his talent.
I think Brown's going to get his minutes no matter what. I think it's going to be the fourth line center that might not get any minutes. I think it all comes down to whether or not Babcock wants to put one of Tavares, Kadri, Matthews, or maybe two of those three playing on the PK. If he's confident and comfortable putting those guys out, then he doesn't need a fourth line center specialist being a penalty killer. And you can throw out Tavares 21 minutes, Matthews 21 minutes, and Kadri the remaining, and just swap the wingers off and on throughout the rest of the game.
So you think maybe if we have a variety of wingers but only three lines, it would be harder to kind of match up, especially because Babcock loves his matchups, especially on home ice. If we have the two extra wingers and we slot them in with different centers, do you think that would create a more advantage for the Leafs?
I think it would be add chaos to matching up with them to the already chaotic matchup. I mean, imagine any team trying to match up against Tavares, Matthews, or Kadri. Kadri was going up against the top lines for all of half the games last year when Babcock had the first change. And try to imagine matching up against lines where you don't even know what center is going to come out with which winger. I think it's just going to be quite chaotic. I think Babcock can really use that to advantage, and he could put an extra defenseman on the blue line on the roster, opening day lineup to help with the
not just the wingers. Look at, if you have Matthews, Tavares, Kadri, any of them playing on the fourth line, you now have that star player playing against other teams' fourth lines. So you're going to have one of Matthews, Tavares, Kadri playing with Connor Brown and Tyler Ennis or Josh Levo against, say, the New York Islanders, where they're going to probably have Matt Barton, Cal Clutterbuck, and Casey Cizikas,
Komarov.
Leo Komarov. And when you look at that, that also adds to the dynamic of how strong the Leafs are offensively.
All right, so if we're going off the idea of doing the 11 forwards and 7D, who would you guys have as your 7th D? So you got Riley, Gardner, Hainsey, Zaitsev as your top four. And then, according to Cap Friendly here, we have Connor Carrick, Travis Dermott, Justin Hull as our NHL defensemen right now, with a bunch of guys on the Marlies, Liljegren, Borgman, Rosen, who we saw a decent amount of games out of last year. Who do you think would take that 7th defenseman, assuming that Carrick gets played, along with Hull, who has a goal per game in the NHL from his two games last year, and Travis Dermott, who had a very good end of the season and playoffs with the Leafs.
I think Travis Dermott is secured on the roster, and the Leafs are going to see what he can do this year just to kind of tell if they're able to move Jake Gardner before his contract expires. And then on the right side, I would probably put Connor Carrick, just because he has more... He's played more games in NHL. He's proven more over that time than Justin Hull over his two games. Even though he's a goal per game player, I think that he'll probably start the season as a 7th defenseman, or they might just do what they did with Borgman and Rosen, and they'll alternate between Carrick and Hull for the first couple games.
Now, Dermott did play a lot on the right side as a Marlie, even though he is a left-handed shot. Do you think that Babcock would be set on him being on the left side behind Riley and Gardner, or do you think that he might get a shot on the right side because of the lack of depth on the right side?
Well, all three of Riley, Dermott, and Hainsey have all have experience on the right side, and if Dermott can prove that he's able to play in the top four, I would not be surprised if Babcock decided to put one of Dermott or Riley on the right side and maybe make that your top pair. Or you can put Gardner on the top line and kind of put Riley and Gardner back together.
I think Dermott's a lock to make the team no matter what. I don't know who's going to be playing the right side. I don't know what Babcock would be thinking there. I don't really have a preference one way or the other. What I find interesting is whether Dermott's going to be good enough this year to be able to take a role on the top four right away, or if that's something that's going to come later on in the year. I think by the end of the season, probably come playoffs time, he's going to be taking a little more time away from Hainsey, hopefully. We saw Hainsey drop off quite a bit last season. And I think Carrick has solidified his spot as at least a number 7. I think Babcock is comfortable putting him in one game but not another, and then coming back the third game playing. Some guys can't come in and out of the lineup as well as Carrick can. So I think it's up to Hull, Ozhiganov, Borgman, and Rosen for the final spot on the team. And I think it's just going to come down to training camp to see who has the best one. Ozhiganov's got a great chance. He's coming over from Russia, but maybe he's only here for a month and heads back home afterwards.
Now, what if Zaitsev lives up to his $4.5 million contract and maybe bumps Hainsey down to the second or even the third line, depending on what Dermott can do? Because I'd love to see Dermott in that top four role, which I don't think he's earned yet, but he has the potential to be up there the way he moves with the puck, the way he passes it off. Yes, he got dinged a lot in the playoffs because Boston would always dump it over to Pollock. Pollock would send it around to Dermott, then Dermott would be suffocated by the Bruins forwards there. But I feel that maybe Hainsey should take a third pairing role along with a PK specialist. So if even if Hainsey's our seventh D, maybe we can focus on him just being able to play the 2 minutes of a penalty kill and be fresh for the next one if he's that seventh defenseman.
Well, Ron Hainsey, I hope, will be on the third line this year. Maybe playing with Connor Carrick, because Carrick is a lot more speedy and he's able to go up and down the ice quicker.
They're both right-handed, though. That's the issue.
Hainsey and
Carrick.
Hainsey's left-handed. He just plays on the right side.
Oh, okay. My bad.
Yeah, so putting Hainsey back at the left side, maybe that'll improve how he's played over the year as well. And playing Carrick with a veteran, maybe it could help him improve his overall game. Plus, I'm hoping that Zaitsev will be able to get back up to what he proved in his first season with the Leafs and doing what he did with Gardner. They had a little dynamic going for them the second half of the season. And last season, Zaitsev was backtracked because of injuries and coming back, and he was not able to get his game going again. But this season, I believe that Zaitsev should be able to get back to where he was once at a point.
I think Zaitsev's going to have a year where plays in between his season last year, which I think we can all agree was just crap. But I think he overachieved his first season, so I think he'll come back to something a little more consistent, and in between those two seasons today, he'll solidify a second pairing spot, maybe as a number four, a decent number four. Dermott, I would love to see be able to play top 4 minutes, but I don't see that happening until at least around the All-Star break, at least. I think Babcock's going to try to protect him until a point where he just can't any longer. I think Justin Hall has the best chance he's ever had of making an NHL roster by far, largely because I think Dubas is going to be a lot more open-minded to take someone like a Hall on the team rather than, say, a Lamorello. Liljegren, I don't think he has a chance of making the team this year. I hope he doesn't. We just don't want to rush him. Let's stick to the overwrite philosophy and let him start dominating next season.
Yeah, and just to touch on Liljegren a little bit, Scott Wheeler of The Athletic had a really good piece saying that he is about a year away. So he might get a few games in the show this year, but it's probably better if he stays on the Marlies this year, dominates the AHL, and then develops into that top four that we need. Maybe he'll have a Dermott year next year where he comes in halfway through and then just shows what he has and dominates in it.
I think that's what's going to happen next year. I think Liljegren's going to come in halfway through the season. He's going to be our addition after and near the trade deadline instead of trading for someone else and trading picks away. I don't think Dubas is going to be doing that very often. I think they're just going to continue to overwrite the guys in the AHL and bring them up whenever they're ready, often halfway through the season, like they did with Dermott, when they're at a point where they're definitely staying no matter what. And it's going to be exciting in a year and a bit when we have Riley, Zaitsev, that's hopefully playing closer to as well as he did his first year, along with a Dermott and a Liljegren. That could be a heck of a top four.
If Liljegren will be coming in halfway through, where would you put him if you're taking out of the lineup?
Well, maybe Ron Hainsey steps into that seventh defenseman role as a penalty kill specialist, plays his 6-8 minutes a night on the penalty kill, which frees up the space for whoever's on our third pairing, maybe as a developmental role. If someone gets hurt, we call up the Marlies and they get their shot to kind of prove themselves.
I don't think Liljegren's going to come in this year, so it would be next year, and we don't know if Gardner's going to be on the team. I think most of us think that he won't be. His contract expires at the end of this season. He's going to be, if he puts up another 51 plus point season, he's going to be looking for 7 years times $7 million a year, and there's just no way the Leafs are going to do it. He's going to have to walk just like JVR walked. It's going to be a similar circumstance. So there's going to be a lot more, there's going to be another opening on the top four all of a sudden.
Now, would you guys be open to maybe trading Gardner for someone who has a year or two left on their contract. Maybe we have to throw in a little bit more, whether it's picks or someone on the Marlies. But to get that extra year, so while we're still kind of under the cap, so we're not re-signing a defenseman at $7 million or whatever Gardner's going to want, because, yeah, you're right, the Leafs can't afford that. But if we can get that extra year or two at the cost of Gardner and a second, maybe a first, depending on the quality and contract of the player, I think that would be a little ideal, because the Leafs are kind of in their win-now mode. Yes, the triplets are going to be great for the next decade or so, depending if they stay that long. But the Leafs want to win now, and I could see Dubas making a smart move where it's Gardner plus for a top two, maybe top three defenseman. What do you guys think?
First of all, it's quadruplets now. Now we have Tavares on the team.
But Tavares is 28, not under 23.
What's your point?
They're not born in the same decade.
Yeah, but he's still a part of that group now.
Does Tavares play Fortnite?
I mean, he could.
He might.
Patrick Marleau might be playing Fortnite.
They were born in the same decade.
There you go.
Not really. There's 90s kids, and then there's kids who were born in the 90s, okay?
I mean, I'm one of those kids that was born in the 90s.
Yeah, see, I was born in the early 90s, but I don't fit in with the kids who were born in 99.
Do you play Fortnite?
I don't.
Well, okay, well, there was my point. Anyways, back to the actual topic, even though I still say Tavares is a part of that group.
Triplets sounds better than quadruplets, though.
I don't know, especially when you have Tavares in that part. Anyways, now I forget what you've been talking about.
It does make it sound sexy, though.
A little bit. Basically, we were talking about how I think that, honestly, I don't know. I completely forget.
Let's just stick to this now. So Fortnite. What do you guys think about Fortnite?
I've played it a few times. I'm not impressed with it. Honestly, I'm not a huge gamer. I'll play my NHL, my FIFA. I enjoy the odd story mode. I'm currently making it through the Zelda game on the Switch. And playing some League of Legends. How about you guys?
See, for some reason, my brain can't comprehend, like, building and shooting at people. And I cannot figure out how to play the game. So I've tried playing it, and I've just gone back to what I'm good at, and I just keep playing NHL, you know, doing like that 3-on-3.
So what you're saying is you're dumb because you can't multitask in a video game.
What I'm saying is that my brain cannot comprehend all the stuff that you need to do in order to win a game. Even though I have won a game just by camping, and that was my only kill in the game, but still, I have won a game that is under my belt.
I only got second, so you got me beat there.
I've never played it. I never will. I don't get it. I'm not a gamer. I'm just happy that the biggest problem we have with young guys in the NHL or OHL now is them staying up till 4 a.m. playing Fortnite instead of staying up till 4 a.m. doing God knows what else.
Okay, but you have to remember, even at the OHL level, the AHL, NHL, whatever level, you need an escape from something. And yes, it's not healthy staying up till 4 a.m. playing a video game, but they need something that's not hockey. And Fortnite, you could call it a team-building experience, especially if you're playing with guys on your team or other players in the league. You're having that kind of sense of community where you're bonding with these guys. And if you guys have, or let's say Matthews and Marner play Fortnite, and they're bonding, right? Yeah, they've been playing for 2 years, but you kind of want to see them have something outside of the team, like all the guys who were at Codger's wedding.
I agree. Let them play Fortnite. Let them play till 6 in the morning. If they show up tired, it's only going to hurt them. It's only going to hurt their draft position if they're in the OHL. It's only going to hurt their ice time if they're already in the NHL. They're doing it to themselves. They'll learn. I'd much rather that than pretty much anything else.
Well, the second thing is, would you rather they're playing Fortnite or would you rather them at a bar getting drunk out of their mind and coming in the next morning not even able to see straight?
Well, to be fair, anything before 1999, maybe even 2010, a lot of these guys were going to the bar getting hammered and showing up to practice the next day, and they were able to do it. Now, yes, obviously I'd rather the kids be playing Fortnite or whatever instead of going to Gracie's or the Maddie, wherever the Leafs players tend to go. But
did they ever go to the Gracies, or are you just making that up?
I think I've heard of some AHL players going there. I don't know if the Leafs have actually gone
Seems
there.
Seems like an AHL thing. That makes sense.
Yeah.
When you're making $60,000 a year living, trying to live downtown Toronto, Gracies makes sense. But yeah, when you're making $600,000 or $6.5 million to go to Gracies on a common, you know,
Tuesday
often,
night,
yeah, then yeah, I don't know. Seems like an AHL thing.
Yeah. All right, so let's take a little move over to news that's a little bit dated because we had our technical difficulties last week. Haley Wickenheiser got hired as a player development role. I know very little about this.
I think it's like the assistant of player development. I'm pretty sure it's something like that.
From what I understood is she's going to be working out in Calgary while she's getting her med school degree, basically with any of our prospects in the WHL. I don't know a whole lot about this, but I think it is a good move because it's kind of breaking that gender barrier in the sport. And just because someone may be female doesn't mean that they're not good at this. Look at that scout that Dubas hired recently, Noelle, I forget her last name. Basically, how Dubas found his scouts this year was he got everyone to submit a scouting report anonymously online, and that way they were able to get rid of any biases, sexist, whatever it may be. And basically Noelle's scouting report was above the rest, and she was picked as a scout for the Toronto Maple Leafs.
It's Noelle Needham, saying that. And going to the point of female roles in the NHL, there's stuff I do agree with and stuff I don't agree with. The parts I don't agree with is people saying that females should be hired just because they're females. That part I do not agree with. You have to have a knowledge of the game. You have to know what you're doing. If she's able to do as much as a guy is, there should not be any reason why she's not in the league. But saying that a girl should just be given a job just because she's a girl is something that I find a little bit ludicrous. And even that, I would say, is sexist in a way.
For the record, I don't think anyone's saying that one, but I get your point. But I think what this leads to, I mean, we already have Barb Underhill as the Leafs skating coach. I mean, so it's not like Noelle or Haley Wickenheiser are the first ones to break this ceiling into the Maple Leafs. I'm sure there's a bunch of organizations out there that don't have any women in those type of roles. A very Fortune 500 public company of Dubas to be on the leading edge of this. So good on him. But I think what we are turning our eyes to now is this opening up a possibility of a female coach one day? You know, assistant coach, whether it be the AHL and head coach, AHL assistant coach in the NHL, someone running the PK or the power play, running the defense, and then, you know, it's only a hop, skip, and a jump away from the head coach if they ever get to that point. And I'm sure it will, but when? Who? I mean, I think Haley would be a pretty unbelievable person to be, you know, running at least part of the bench to start one day if she ever had the desire to.
Now, yes, I agree that Haley would have this potential skill to be a coach. But look at the greatest coach the Phoenix/Arizona Coyotes ever had in their tenure, Wayne Gretzky. He was the best hockey player ever, and when it came to coaching, he just didn't have that. Now, I believe, yes, eventually there will be one day where there will be females in the coaching roles. I just feel that for the time being, we're in that old boys club kind of, everyone gets recycled and rehired at different clubs because everyone knows each other. Dubas is kind of setting that mold for the future where you hire the best person available, not just because they're your buddy. This will kind of open the door for females to come into the hockey industry.
I think this is where Dubas's
analytical mind comes into play. He's seen as a stats and analytical guy, and people don't give enough credit for how much of a hockey eye he has. But I think that when he allows these scouts to talk about, submit scouting reports anonymously online, it adds a equal barrier to everyone. Everyone has the same fair chance. I think that's where his analytical mind comes into play more than anything. And I think that's only an advantage to Dubas and to the Maple Leafs.
Again, with the female roles in coaching, I think that they can get there as long as they're proving that they're able to do it. Looking at examples of Mike Babcock, he never played in the NHL, but he went through college, he went through the AHL, I think, or he went straight into the NHL, but he was able to prove that he is a good coach and that he is able to coach in the NHL. And if a female is able to do that as well, then I don't see any reason why they shouldn't be hired to begin with.
All right, while we're on the subject of retired hockey players, Patrick Marleau's contract is up in 2 years, which means he has this year and next year as a Toronto Maple Leaf, or that's what it is as it stands right now. He is owed his signing bonus on July 1st, 2019, and then he has $1 million worth of actual salary for the remaining years. Do you think that he's going to stay on the Leafs? Is he going to get traded, bought out? What do you guys think is going to happen to Patty?
Considering he has a no-moving clause, I think the only way Marleau is leaving Toronto is if they're sending him back to San Jose or even Tampa Bay, just because Tampa Bay is an absolute beast team and Marleau wants to win a Stanley Cup. Otherwise, I don't see him going anywhere unless the Leafs are going to pull a Rhode Island and throw him there somehow. But he's also too good of a player to even put there. So, honestly, in my opinion, I think he's going to end up staying just because they're not going to be able to get him out or for him to waive his moving clause. I just don't see a realistic option of that happening.
I agree. I think Marleau's going to play out his full 3-year contract. I think afterwards he's going to want another 1 or 2 year contract somewhere. I think he's only really interested in Toronto or San Jose. He's come to Toronto to win the Stanley Cup. The only way that Marleau is retiring or going to Robita Island, which I think is a much smaller island now that Lou is gone, now that we don't have Loophole Lou. The only way that Marleau isn't going to be back after next season is, yes, if he gets traded back to San Jose, if they're a contender, or if the Maple Leafs win the Cup this year.
Now, what if we had maybe the possibility of a buyout?
What would that look like? Do we know?
I don't think he can do that because he has a no-moving clause.
No, you can buy him out. I'm reading it here on Cap Friendly right now. It's a 35-plus contract, and therefore the buyout has no effect on the player's cap hit. So, unfortunately, that wouldn't help the Maple Leafs with what they can do, as we now know.
So it wouldn't matter?
No. But basically, it would just split his cap hit, split paying him over the next 2 years, so he would get an extra year of salary.
That doesn't make any sense for the Leafs, do they? It wouldn't help him in any way.
But could you not send him to Arizona, the all-star team, including Pavel Datsyuk and Chris Pronger, and then they have them buy him out. So he basically gets his last year to not play over 2 years.
He still can't do that because he has to waive his no-moving clause to go to Arizona in the first place.
What if he wants? Now, I understand he wants to win a cup, but if Dubas talks to him and is like, hey, we want to do this. We appreciate everything you've done for us over the past 2 years. We really want to send you to Arizona. You get to go home at 39, or is he 40? However old he is next summer, and go spend it with your kids. You still get paid. We appreciate everything you've done. Just
no way. Marleau's sticking. He's not going to accept that. I think he's going to want to play even longer if he hasn't won a cup in the next 2 years. I think he's an absolute Iron Man. He's not going to be injured anytime soon. He's still got rockets for legs. There's no loophole move. There's no Robot Island for Marlowe coming up. He's on the Maple Leafs, or he gets traded back to San Jose. If San Jose picks up, say, a Sagan-type guy, or maybe Sagan himself, and you know, becomes a real contender again for the Stanley Cup, then maybe he'll allow a trade back. But he's also not going to want to move his family again after only 2 years. So I find it really hard to believe that Marlowe isn't playing at least two more full seasons for the Maple Leafs.
Not just that, but you're also setting a bad precedent to your team. If you can do something like that to a player of Marlowe's stature, of what he's done in the NHL, then you can do that to any player. And I think that will leave a bad taste in a lot of players' mouths, and they probably wouldn't want to come to Toronto as much as they do right now. So all being said, I agree with Jay that Marlowe will be spending the next 2 years in Toronto.
All right, so we talked a lot about the Leafs the first podcast, and for about half an hour or so this podcast. Let's kind of switch over to the plus side, so to speak. The NHL Network released their top 10 goalies. Basically, in a list, we have Sergei Bobrovsky, Holtby, Vasilevsky, Hellebuck, Quick, Fleury, Rene, Rask, Freddie Anderson, and John Gibson. What do you guys think about that list? Is there anyone you think should be higher, lower, left on, put on?
First of all, I think Freddie being listed above Gibson, who Anaheim had a chance to choose from,
to keep,
is pretty fun.
Another thing to say is Carey Price is not on that list, and I'm happy to see that because I don't like the Montreal Canadiens. Second thing to say is Pekka Rinne won the Vezina, and he's ranked sixth.
He also had some pretty bad years the last previous year and a half. I mean, he had a good run this year, but to be honest, I thought he was kind of washed up leading into this season. He obviously proved me wrong, but it's for me, it's Quick, who is way too high on this list. I don't. He's got a couple cups under his belt, but that was quite a few years ago. He's not helping his team make the playoffs, and he's an okay, maybe even at times a great playoff goalie, but you stack him up stat for stat in the regular season, and he's an average goaltender at best, I think, in the NHL.
Well, if you're going off of over the last couple of years, as you said with Pekka Rinne, then why wouldn't Carey Price be on this list? Why is Vasilevsky and Hellebuck so high on the list? They're ranked 3 and 4th, or 3rd and 4th, and Hellebuck, he's done nothing except for this year. This is his 1 year where he's actually proven that he can be a starter in the NHL.
Now, just a reminder for anyone who doesn't know, the Vezina is voted on by the 31 general managers. So there might be some bias there. It might be picking the other guy over someone in your division, so to speak. Like, there's a couple different things affecting that list. Honestly, I understand why Carey Price isn't on the list. He hasn't been great. Yes, the team in front of him is garbage, and I'm not just saying that as a Leaf fan. It's proven.
Saying that as a Leaf fan.
You have to realize that Carey Price hasn't had a solid season in 2 years,
yep,
give or take. He's only been hot in streaks, and when the streaks are hot, yeah, he's unbeatable. He's a brick wall. You can't get anything by him. But those are far and few between, and when he signed his contract extension for 8 years, we were actually closer to the 2010 Olympics where did he play that? No, he wasn't even on the roster to the end of his contract, just to put it in perspective.
So let's look at it this way. Of the 10 that are on the list right now, who would we want, or who would we take next season above Carey Price? Because for me, for sure Bobrovsky. I think he's the best goalie in the league, and I don't even think it's close. I would take Holtby, I would take Vasilevsky, I would not take Hellebuck because he's too young.
Are we taking them as if we're building a team, or are we taking it as Leaf fans?
Away. As a team, right?
So like if we're an NHL, be a GM
or
something.
If we were a GM and we could pick one goalie just for next season alone, who would we pick? I above price. I would take Bobrovsky, Holtby, Vasilevsky, and that actually might be it, because I think he might be some of these other guys, the Fleury, Rene, Rask, Freddie, Gibson, may have better seasons, but I think the upside for Carey Price is a lot higher. Although, considering his last two seasons, the downside might be a lot lower.
Now, does for that choosing, is the cap in effect there? Because I do not want a $10.5 million goaltender that can't stay healthy on my team.
Let's say yes.
Then, out of that list, I would not take Price over any of those guys. Now going back to you saying Bobrovsky is the best goaltender in the NHL, that I don't agree with. I think Holtby is, or even Vasilevsky. Over this season, he was able to prove what he was able to do with some incredible saves behind the back. He had a couple against the LA Kings where they had a nice 2-on-1 and he just dove over and got his hand behind his back to stop the puck. And stuff like that really proves his capabilities of how strong of a goaltender he really is. And I think he could be number one in the NHL one day.
See, the thing is about behind-the-back saves or stick saves or whatever, you're doing a last-ditch effort there. You're trying to throw something in front of the net to block it. Yes, they look amazing on the highlight reel the next morning when you see them doing the behind-the-back save or the stick save or diving across the crease. But that just means that they were out of position or they didn't read the play right. And to me, I feel that that affects your quote-unquote skill as a goalie because you messed up. Yes, everyone's going to make mistakes and errors doing so. But I feel that, like, look at Curtis McElhinney. He's playing 90s goalie right there, at like Brodeur and Hasek. They were all over the net. They were making diving saves because they were out of position. They weren't ready for the shot or the play. And yeah, it looked amazing, but I'd rather have a safer goalie who maybe plays a little bit deeper in the net, gives him that extra split second of reaction time to see the puck coming and to stop the puck, than playing too far out, too far to one side, whatever it may be, not reading the play properly.
See, I can get your point there, but you also have to realize when you're on a 2-on-1, there's only so much of a way that you can play it. You're either taking the shot or you're taking the pass. And most goalies, when they're taking the shot and the player ends up passing the puck, that puck's going in the net. Vasilevsky has been able to prove that even when he's taking the shot, he can stop the pass as well. He can make that save.
But is that Vasilevsky himself, or is that having the strong Tampa Bay defense playing the pass, so, or playing the player to defend that?
I mean, when he's able to dive across the net and have that behind-the-back save, even on a break, I'm pretty sure he did that on a breakaway as well to Anze Kopitar. I'm not 100% sure, but on that breakaway, a lot of goalies get moved out of position. And being able to have that last-ditch effort, and he hasn't just done it once, he's done it a couple of times, proving that it's something that he's able to do. It's not just a lucky thing.
So the last few Vezina winners, Rene, Bobrovsky, Holtby, Price, Rask, Bobrovsky. What is the only name that we hear twice?
Bobrovsky.
What name do we not hear even once?
I mean, Vasilevsky's still a new goalie in the NHL.
Not really.
Look at Matt Murray. He's won 2 Stanley Cups. Has he won a Vezina?
No.
Has Bobrovsky won a Stanley Cup?
You got to remember, the 2 seasons that Matt Murray won the Stanley Cup, he also had Fleury there, who coincidentally is on this list. Vasilevsky's been playing starting minutes since the Tampa Bay Lightning traded Bishop to Dallas. So that's 2 seasons right
traded
there.
To the Kings.
Right, to the Kings, and they signed with Dallas in the offseason. Basically, Vasilevsky's at the point where if he is a Vezina quality goalie, I feel like he should be, where is he, 3rd? I think that's a good spot for him, but again, it's if he's making all these behind-the-back saves and all that, as a last-ditch effort, it's not good skill. It's just him throwing himself in front of the net, trying to block it.
And Holtby, I mean, being number two, last year I would have put him number two behind Bobrovsky for sure. After this last season, when it was Philip Grubauer that might have been the guy that ultimately took them to the cup, which obviously it was not, it ended up being Holtby. But, you know, it being such a close race down the stretch come playoff time of who was going to lead that team at net, I think Holtby showed a lot of weakness, and I know that's, you can, you know, punch holes in that cheese, make a Swiss cheese, you know, with that argument, because he won the cup. But I think Philip Grubauer was pretty darn close to taking over that number one spot, and if I was Washington, I might have been looking at getting rid of Holtby and keeping Grubauer after the season.
It's like the same thing with who's their coach? The guy who just won.
Barry Trotz.
If he went out in the first round against Columbus, which they were a bounce away from doing because they won game three in double overtime.
And who is Columbus's goalie?
Bobrovsky. If Barry Trotz loses in the first round, you don't think he's getting fired instead of extended or attempted to extend with the Washington Capitals? No, they would have just let him go. He would have maybe not even found a job in New York. Not saying he's a bad coach, but he wouldn't have the same opportunities that he would have won if he, or he would have had if he didn't win.
Barry Trotz could have still gone anywhere. I think had they not won the cup this year, even if they lost in the finals, they would have looked fine for getting rid of Trotz. They won it, still wouldn't re-sign him, which was ludicrous, but that decision was made well before playoff time. But I think no matter what, even if he's gone to the first round against Columbus, he probably would be on the Islanders still right now.
Just for what it's worth, Vasilevsky did not get a first place ballot for Vezina voting, whereas Toronto's Frederik Andersen and Vegas Golden Knights' Marc-Andre Fleury did get first place votes. Vasilevsky did finish in third behind Rene and Hellebuck, whereas Andersen and Fleury finished fourth and fifth respectively. But you got to think that there's some GMs out there who don't rate Vasilevsky as good as he is.
Well, they're also taking into account how good a team Tampa is, and that's playing on a good team like Tampa kind of hurts Vasilevsky's value, I would say, just because.
But Nashville and Winnipeg are the top two teams in the West, so that argument saying that Tampa is getting negative points, so to speak, doesn't really help you.
So let's move this conversation a little bit to who would you rather, 8 or 9, Tuukka Rask, number 8, or the Danish Wolf, Frederik Andersen, at number 9?
Frederik.
Let's not try to be homers here.
Frederik Andersen.
Why?
Just because I like him. He's good.
He's younger.
He's cheaper.
Is he cheap? Yeah. What's Rask's cap? Do we know that?
2 seconds, and I'll find it.
I know for a fact he's over $6 million, and Freddie's at, I think, like 5.4 or something like that.
So Boston Bruins. Tuukka Rask is making $7 million flat, and Freddie is making
five for five.
I believe something similar to that. Let me just pull it up here. Freddie is making, yeah, $5 million for the next 3 years.
Yeah, for a 5-year total.
So you're getting an equivalent goalie at $2 million cheaper.
Yeah, I would take Fireball Freddie because that's one thing you alluded to, Chris, his age, cheaper contract, and I think he still has more of an upside than Rask at this point. I think Rask is could be peaking on the decline any season now, where I'm not that concerned about Freddie falling.
Not just that, but Tuukka Rask has also proven a couple of times that he's a hothead in the net. Even in the AHL, there's a clip on YouTube I saw a couple months ago from like a couple years ago when he was in the AHL, he threw his stick against the board, and he's done that a couple times.
Didn't he have a milk crate too?
Cut off.
I think he threw a milk crate. Was that Tuukka?
I know Quick's also a hothead, but could be wrong.
Like, even though he's a good goaltender, I would rather have a nice, calm,
goalie in Frederik Andersen over somebody who loses his temper over a bad goal.
And you know Babcock wants the calm guy too over the hothead. I don't think a hothead goalie could last. And I think that's a big reason why Garrett Sparks will not be the long-term backup in Toronto. I think he's too much of, you know, we know most goalies are a little different than others, and I think Sparks takes a little more maintenance to take care of than a McElhinney or even a Freddie, and I don't think a Sparks versus Freddie competition is actually healthy. Competition is usually nice, but I don't think that's a good one.
I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Leafs Plus podcast, where we always bring stuff back to the Leafs, even when we're in the Plus section of the podcast. All right, so continuing on our Leafs Plus area of the podcast, Luke Fox was on the Steve Dangle podcast last night, and basically Steve and the gang, Adam, Jesse, were getting hot takes from all their guests that they've had on this summer. Chris Johnson is still thinking about his. Luke Fox had an interesting one that I think we should at least discuss. Now remind you that this is a hot take and there's no significance behind it yet. There's no news, no rumors, articles. He thinks that PK Subban is getting traded.
Is this like a guess? Like these hot takes, what do you mean by hot takes?
So last year, Mike Katsaros, I forget his Twitter handle, I think it's Cats Hockey, K-A-T-Z Hockey, he went on and said that the Chicago Blackhawks weren't going to make the playoffs last year, and he was right. So they kind of want to have these hot takes where the people can come back on next summer and be like, I told you so. So, like I said,
predicting the most unpredictable but realistic possibility.
Yeah. Basically, they're putting a bet on themselves or their ideas of hockey to say, yeah, this is going to happen. Honestly, I don't see it happening. I think it would make a great story, which is what we would all like to hear. But I don't know where he would go. Thoughts?
Vegas.
Is Vegas just our... You guys are going here because they have cap room and picks and all that?
They have cap room. They have picks. They
have prospects.
They have prospects. They need a top D-man. And let's be real. If someone's personality fits Las Vegas, it's PK Subban.
That's a valid point. But I don't see Subban going anywhere. I think Nashville is his home. They have the cap space for him. I don't think they have anybody coming up in the next couple of years that really needs a huge upgrade in their pay. So saying that, I think Subban is perfectly fine in Nashville. I don't see any reason for them to trade him unless they're getting somebody better, which I can't see happening considering cap space and what they have to give up on top of Subban. But Nashville's in a win-now mode. There's no reason for them to trade him for prospects and picks.
What about Vancouver? I mean, we know that Lyndon was fired because he wanted to do the slow and steady build while Jim Benning came in and talked about a much faster rebuild, and ownership was liking Benning's idea a heck of a lot more, and they couldn't have the two competing ideas, ideologies anymore, so they had to get rid of Lyndon, who, if he ran for premier of BC tomorrow, he would win. I mean, the guy is loved in that area, and they fired him. So you know that ownership is wanting to speed up this rebuild, and
they were almost in on Carlson until Carlson shut it down.
Apparently, so if they don't get Carlson, I mean, wouldn't Subban make a lot of sense?
Okay, but what would you give up in terms of Vancouver's prospects? They don't have a whole lot.
Ojulari would be part of it. I think he'd have to be, and definitely would be part of any Carlson trade. I think he'd be part of any Subban trade as well. Plus, I don't know. You're keeping Pedersen. You're keeping Bosser, you're probably giving up a first pick or a first rounder or two that's lottery protected, along with Ole Olevi.
I was going to say, you have to include Ole Olevi in there. And speaking of Jim Benning and Trevor Linden, that battle, that's literally like looking at Brian Burke and what he tried doing versus what Kyle Dubas is doing now. You would think, seeing how both systems worked and how Brian Burke's kind of blew up internal space, especially that Kessel trade, how he ended up giving up Sagan and Hamilton for him. Looking at that, you can see how the Dubas way is a lot slower and better than the Burke way, which is faster and can blow up in your face as much as it can work in your favor.
Well, the Dubas way is a Shanahan way, it's a Shanahan plan, and that's would have been a longer way had we not won the draft ladder and got Matthews. I mean, I think that changed it all. We got pretty lucky on a bunch of things. Arizona picking Strom, so we select Marner, you know, losing the Devils in the last game of the season to be last in the league to get the best chance of Matthews, winning Matthews, and so on. Now signing JT, you know, signing Marlowe. Whether we think it makes sense or not, doing a faster rebuild is obviously what Vancouver's plan is. And how do you do that without picking up a big name? A Carlson, Tavares is no longer around. Maybe they'll be in on trying to get a Sagan. I mean, we know Sagan just made a couple comments on how he was disappointed. He hasn't signed a long-term contract with Dallas yet. Well, if Dallas gets Carlson, can they afford Sagan afterwards? Do they want him? Would they want to trade him and get some picks for him? Probably not. They probably want to keep him. But would Vancouver make a play for Sagan, or in this case, for what we're talking about, Subban? I mean, if Subban's going to get traded, I think Jim Benning would be at the forefront trying to make the best offer he could.
Doesn't Subban have a no-moving clause coming up soon? Like, this either kicked in this year or to next year? As soon as that no-moving clause kicks in, I don't see him waving to go to Vancouver. Vancouver's management is just too much of a hassle to be a part of it.
I think it already kicked in. I think that's why Montreal traded Subban for Weber, because it happened right before his no-move or no-trade, whatever he may have, clause kicks in. So, sure, it would have to be okay by PK, but you never know what the guys are thinking.
Now, just throwing it out there, as Leaf fans, we talked a lot about this defenseman on Vancouver, Chris Tanev. Could Chris Tanev plus a first plus prospect maybe go to Nashville? Because Tanev's only making $4,450,000, which is less than half of Subban's $9 million. You throw in maybe a Bo Horvat or Jake Virtanen, and a pick, because that would be pretty good in my eyes if I'm Nashville. But again, PK has to approve it. I'm looking at cap friendly here, and Vancouver's not that great.
I don't see Vancouver trading Bo Horvat. He looks like to be their next captain, and Jake Virtanen looks like to be a bust. So I don't see him adding really much of any value to a trade. On top of that, I don't see why Nashville would want Chris Tanev, who can't play a full season without being injured, for a premier defenseman in the league in PK Subban. They don't need picks. They're going for the cup now. They don't need to downgrade on a player just for a couple of picks.
I think if this trade happened, this would be after this season. I think Nashville would be crazy not to go at least one more season. And of course, this is all hypothetical just based on Luke Fox's hot take of, you know, Subban maybe being traded. But if it happens, I think it would happen at the end of the season, after the playoffs. But when it comes to Chris Tanev, that guy scares the shit out of me. All these rumors of how Leafs could take Chris Tanev, he can't even play half a season half the time. If I was a GM, I wouldn't value him at all, because he's just too unpredictable with his injuries.
Now, I don't know if you guys remember it, but I'm going to bring it back to the Leafs for a second. Frankie Corrado. Frankie Corrado was a Vancouver Canuck. Frankie Corrado was injured a lot.
Frankie Corrado for PK Subban, you heard it here.
No, that's not where I'm going. There's a paper out in BC that I believe Frankie did an interview. I could be wrong. I don't I think it was Frankie, but it could have been another player who got out of Vancouver. And basically he said that the training staff out there is garbage. They played him when he wasn't healthy, made the injury worse, and did a whole bunch of shenanigans that maybe affected his career. Maybe he would be a great player if he had the proper health and everything behind it. What I'm saying is maybe Tanev's a product of that health and the doctors over in Vancouver. Because like he hasn't been healthy. If he comes to the Leafs with a lot of money for doctors, a lot of money for rehab, training, everything like that, maybe he is that number top four defenseman that we've been waiting on.
The problem with that is what other players in Vancouver have the same problem that Tanev does.
But that's
I don't see any other players that keep getting injured over and over and over again. There's some players that just get injured because that's just how their bodies are. Look at Joffrey Lupo with what Toronto had. Joffrey Lupo is still getting injured year in, year out, hand injuries, just freak accidents. I think Tanev is the same way. He's just somebody who just can't not be injured.
I mean, it is an interesting take to maybe that's what's dragging out his injuries. If the Vancouver staff isn't making the greatest decisions, putting Tanev in when he shouldn't, or not properly rehabbing him. But I think if you're a GM making a move based on that, maybe it's just too big of a risk. I wouldn't do it.
No, and I completely get that. He would have to do physicals in Toronto. I'm just saying maybe Chris Tanev is the player that the media sees him as a top four on any team. That's just not worth working right now.
I definitely think he's a top four on any team when healthy.
Well, not Nashville.
If they get rid of Subban. Well, let's look at Nashville's...
If Nashville acquires Tanev without giving up any of their top four defensemen, he's not going to be in the top four. He'll be a top six defenseman.
So Subban, Josi, Ekholm, and Ellis are all better than Tanev, healthy?
Well, I would question Ekholm being better, but Tanev's right-handed, Ekholm's left-handed. I'd rather have my left hand on the left side and my right hand on the right side. So I would say Ryan Ellis and P.K. Subban are better than Chris Tanev, and Tanev will end up on the third pairing because of that.
That would be a hell of a third pairing, though.
That would be very scary. Plus, they still have Dante Fabro in the minors as well. Nashville is stacked on defense, and they had Seth Jones at one point.
And Carolina. That Seth Jones trade, that one pisses me off. I hated that one from the get-go. Seth Jones is a better player than Ryan Johansson. Seth Jones has always been a better player or prospect than Ryan Johansson. And Nashville screwed themselves by making that trade. They had to pay Ryan Johansson $8 million a year, and he's not even close to that type of player. I mean, you can make the argument that they had no other choice, but they haven't won a cup since. It's going to be hard to when he's your number one defenseman, I think. I think he'd be an unreal number two, but I think they had to wait out a little longer to make a better deal. To still have Seth Jones on your team right now over a $8 million Ryan Johansson, I think that would be that might be a better team even now. Even with a lesser center core.
Not just that, but they had Shea Weber at that point, and they were saying that Weber is our guy, he's our right guy, he's a right-handed defenseman, our top-pairing guy. And trading him, it shows that you could have kept Jones and just moved Weber instead. Still could have had that superstar defenseman just like a decade younger.
Would you go back and trade Weber for Johansson?
If I was Nashville, I would, but I don't think Columbus would. I think you would have to make a three-way trade with Montreal, get Subban to Columbus, Johansson to you, Weber to Montreal. That would have to work like that. I think that trade would have worked out. And you still have Jones.
No, that would have been a blockbuster and a half.
Yeah, that would have been insane.
All right, and now time for the question part of the podcast. We got a few questions. We'll redo some from last week and put in a few that No one seemed to want to message us today, so we'll just pull a few that we might, that we found on Twitter and we haven't answered yet. So the big one, we remember seeing it, we don't remember who said it, so sorry if you're listening right now, please scream at us on Twitter and we'll apologize and retweet you. But at what moment did you think that the rebuild ended?
I think the rebuild ended as soon as Matthews scored that empty netter against the Pittsburgh Penguins to put the Leafs into the playoffs. That kind of proved that the Leafs are able to make it to the playoffs and that they're able to compete. Even in that Washington series, even though the Leafs lost in six games, they kept up with Washington. They went to five overtimes. That series could have went either way.
I don't think the rebuild's over yet. I mean, I think we're one really, really solid defenseman short of that rebuild being over. I think the guys are still learning, the triplets, the quadruplets, or whatever you guys want to call them.
The quadruplets,
okay. They're great. We're 95% of the way there. We got a solid center core. We have great goaltenders. We have a good amount of top 4D, but we're still one really good one short. Now, if you want to pick one moment that you could argue that the Maple Leafs organization thought the rebuild was more or less over, I would point to the Centennial Classic when Matthews scored in overtime and the camera goes up to Shanahan and Dubas and they just start cheering like the rest of us would be at home. I mean, I think that was, in a lot of management minds, a big turning point in, if for no other reason other than these volumes.
See, you guys got it all wrong. Yes, Matthews is nice and all. Yes, maybe yesterday I would have said when we drafted Matthews or when we won the lottery. My big idea right now is when the Leafs got rid of the old guard, when JVR, Bozak, Watt, and we started our new generation with Tavares.
I knew you were going to say that.
It's just...
That makes a lot of sense.
Because well, you got to think about it. You get rid of all the old Burt guys. Yes, there's a few remaining, like Gardner's an old pick. Riley, I don't think was Burt, but he was still older there.
Kadri.
I think Kadri's the last... because he was picked before Gardner and Riley.
Well, Gardner wasn't even a part of that. Gardner was traded for it.
But was it a Burt trade?
Yeah, it was Shen.
Yeah, see, so it's...
What about Janssen? Wasn't he a Burt pick, seventh round?
No. He was a Hunter pick, or Hunter Dubas pick.
Janssen was?
Yeah.
Okay, what about Brown?
No, Brown was a...
Was that a notice or a Burt pick?
I think that was a Burt pick, because that was the same draft as Morgan Riley.
Yeah, 2012.
Yeah.
He was drafted. Andreas Janssen. So yeah, basically... I think that's when it ended. We got rid of all the old guys who, I don't want to say didn't have the winning culture, but they've been through so many hard seasons with the Leafs. They went through the Horacek truck off a cliff that a lot of the team had to go through.
I forgot about him.
Yeah. Like,
I don't think anybody really remembers him.
I remember being at the gym that night against Winnipeg when it was... Who's before Horacek?
Carlisle?
Yeah, Carlisle got fired the day after. I remember being at the game, or at the gym that day, and I'm like, okay, I can't do this anymore. And then the next day, or a few days later, before the next game, it's like, yep, it's done. Horacek is our new interim coach.
Do we know where Horacek is right now?
I can definitely look it up. I just remember, basically, we were in a playoff spot at that moment. But I think it was just too many losses. And
we ended up winning, what, like three of the last 21 games or something?
Oh, something garbage like that, yeah.
And Horacek goes from a possible head coaching candidate to a bunch of teams in the NHL to, I don't know, where is he now if we figured that out?
He is a pro scout for the New Jersey Devils.
He's not even coaching anymore.
No. But
that was the end of coaching for him.
Well, he only technically coached 108 games in the NHL. He did 66 with Florida in 2013-14. I just came over to the Leafs as the assistant and then took over halfway through the season and coached 42 games and had a win percentage of 21.4. So just over 1 in 5 games he won as a Leaf coach.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, he went 9-28 over those 42. That doesn't add up. Wikipedia is wrong. What?
No way.
Oh, wait, wait.
You're supposed to look at Wikipedia.
Okay, I forgot overtime and shootout losses.
They're not incredible
sores.
Don't you remember what the teachers always told you?
Wikipedia is always right. I just read it wrong. So, yeah, basically, now that we have Babcock, we have Matthews, the savior, we have Nylander Marner as his white knights, left and right hands or whatever, you have Tavares, you have Kadri on his amazing contract. It was that point where I'm like, okay, this is for real now. I cried when we won the lottery to get Matthews. I was like, it's happening.
I was in the washroom, not gonna lie.
What?
Yeah, I thought I was trying at 7:30. It was at 7. Man, yeah, that was rough.
Okay, well, you finish your thing, and I'll tell you my.
I remember being, because it was Canada Day. I was up north with the boys. I remember being hung over on that couch and my mind was racing. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it. Yes, my body didn't show that emotion because I couldn't move, but my mind was like, holy crap, we got Tavares. And I just remember being in that moment and I'm just like, it happened. This is actually happening now. This is for real. This is our next step to possibly ending a 50-year drought. 51, 52-year drought, it's going to happen. And I think it was, we got rid of the old guard and Tavares came in. And that's my personal opinion on this.
When we got Tavares, I was on a Sunday, starting on Friday, I was sitting at my desk in my office, just hitting refresh. I went in Saturday morning back to my office because I wanted a desktop, I wanted to see it on a big screen, not an iPad or my phone. Nothing happens Saturday, I come Sunday, and refresh. Finally it happens. But when we won the lottery for Matthews, I lost it. I was living out in California, and I'm sitting there on my couch on the edge waiting for the results. And I lived in an apartment, and it was on the ground floor. You had front door, back door, and front door, back door, whatever you want to call it, went onto basically the sidewalk on the busy downtown street. It was a small gate, but you know, it wasn't much to it. It was basically right on the sidewalk. And as soon as we won the lottery, my girlfriend opens the door as I am losing my mind to a point where there was a guy on the street, stopped walking, turned around, came back to the door to talk to my girlfriend to make sure that she was okay, because I was yelling so loud that it scared random people on the street, thought my girlfriend was in trouble.
So while you're screaming and you're crying, I was dropping a deuce. That's my story.
This is the Classy Leafs Plus podcast.
I had my brother bang on the door yelling at me saying Leafs won Matthews, and I was like, perfect, let me finish.
People think that my girlfriend's in trouble because of me is I'd rather that than
dropping a deuce.
Dropping a deuce.
I thought it was at 7:30, but it was at 7. I got my times wrong.
I was on the West Coast and I knew what time it was.
And if you were on the West Coast and you witnessed this potential domestic abuse, please contact us and we'll send you all an autographed picture.
Fine. I was yelling at the TV. It was excitement.
He supposedly said.
I said potential domestic. Let us know and we'll send you an autographed picture of John Tavares signed by us because
we're not going to get Tavares to sign us.
Yeah. Okay. So next question.
This podcast is going downhill real fast.
James Reeves.
Fortnite.
James Reeve at James RJ Reeve, R-E-E-V-E, wants to know what we think about Picard possibly being shopped.
Is it Picard or is it Pickard?
Pickard.
Doesn't matter. Anyways, I think it's smart by the Leafs. I want Sparks to be the backup, even though I know Jade is going to say that he does not. I think Sparks, that's his job to take. McElhinney's too old to keep it. There's no reason for McElhinney to stay. Picard has NHL experience, but he hasn't been able to prove that he can keep the job. And while Sparks has been in the NHL, he has not done much there. But last season, he led the entire AHL in, what was it, save percentage and goals against average. He was the best goalie in the AHL. And being the best goalie in the AHL, I think that you're able to have a backup role, at least in the NHL.
You think McElhinney's not good enough to hold the...
I think McElhinney's good enough. I just think he's too old now to keep him. Why would you keep McElhinney?
Maybe you should go drop another deuce.
I mean, I will be after this. But anyways, besides that, let's not go to my personal life.
Because trading Calvin Pickard, I don't think makes any sense from what I know. I think keeping Sparks, or trading Sparks, is what needs to happen. Sparks is going to be claimed off waivers once they send him to the Marlies, if they send him to the Marlies. So you either got to keep him or trade him. I don't think keeping him is a good decision for two reasons. One, because McElhinney is not too old, and he was the best backup in the league last year, and that he has earned Babcock's trust. And if you put in a guy like Sparks, who I touched on earlier, he's a lot more high maintenance than the McElhinney, it's going to drive Babcock nuts and be a complete distraction for him. I think you're just causing chaos on the roster there for no good reason. I think you get an okay pick for Sparks, so you get something for him. You bring up Kaskisuo to the Marlies. Him and Pickard battle it out for the first starting spot on the Marlies. McElhinney becomes, or continues to be, the solid backup that Babcock can put in at any time. And Freddie rules the world, and we go with a cup.
For just so our listeners at home can understand the stats on our three AHL goalies, Derek Sparks did lead in both goals against average and save percentage. Picard was 12th in the AHL with a 918. And Kaskisuo, who we actually loaned to Chicago, had a 916. And basically all three of them were in the top 10 for goals against average.
I think when going back to Freddie in Anaheim, I think he wasn't doing too well when there was a competition between him and Gibson. He likes knowing that he's the number one guy. And if Garrett Sparks comes in and becomes a backup, he's going to want to be the number one guy. And I don't think that's putting Freddie in the position that is best for him. Competition is always great, but goalies are finicky. You got to protect them sometimes. Freddie's our guy. Let's protect him. McElhinney's never going to try to be the number one. Garrett Sparks is. Let's not create animosity. Let's have Pickard and Kaskisuo fight out. Let's trade Sparks while he's not injured for the first time ever, and sell high.
What you do with Sparks is you do with him what other teams in NHL have done. You give him a backup role. You let him show that he's able to be a solid goalie in the NHL. You get his trade value up, and then you ship him off. That's the smartest way to do it. That's what New York did with Cam Talbot. That's what San Jose did with Martin Jones. Obviously, I'm not saying Sparks is able to become that. He can one day. Right now, it's not a likely possibility, but it's still a possibility of that happening, and I don't see any reason to chip him off now when you can get his trade value higher than it is right now.
What did Grubauer get?
Contract-wise?
No, what... he was traded, wasn't he?
I'm pretty sure he came to the...
What did they give up for Grubauer?
He got traded with Brooks Orpik, so that also lifted up what the return was. I'm pretty sure they got like a second round pick for him.
Yeah, so I think best case scenario you're ever going to get in a trade from Garrett Sparks straight up, that's if we go down the philosophy of where he plays some NHL games and looks good, is a second rounder. I think that's the best case. Right now you can get a
probably a fourth rounder for sure, maybe a third rounder. I think that one or two rounds is too risky. You risk him not doing well and stop going down. You risk him getting injured, which is quite likely considering his history. I don't think the one or two round increase is worth creating possible animosity between Freddie and whoever the backup is, I guess, Sparks.
Okay, but the thing is, Sparks wants that number one role, and I'm not saying that he's going to beat Freddie out for it. I feel that Sparks is going to want to try and play his best, and you got to remember, Freddie played 64 games? 66 games last season, which means the other goalies, it wasn't just Matt Delaney, it was the season before that we had the...
Enroth.
Yeah, that worked out well. 66 games. He's 28. He's not as good as, let's say, Hellebuck, who's 4 years younger and played an extra game, right? Freddie is not hitting old man status, but he's kind of hitting that peak, and we don't know when he's going to tip over that and maybe slow down a little bit.
I mean, I think goalies hit their peak a little later than, like...
Oh, for sure. I totally get that.
Look at how long Henrik Lundqvist was a solid goalie for him. Look at Marc-Andre Fleury.
Yeah.
He's, what, 34 now? 33, 34, maybe 32.
Who, Fleury?
I don't know.
Yeah, Fleury. Well, he was drafted in the year before Malkin.
33.
Yeah. And so look at the year that he just had.
Yeah. No, and I'm not saying that Freddie's going to go down next season. I'm just saying if we keep playing him 60-plus games a year, it's too much. And especially if we want him fresh for the playoffs, maybe even have... Because Freddie has terrible Octobers. It's consistent. Why not have... like a goalie tryout, fake, in air quotes, an injury, so Freddie doesn't have to go on waivers or send him down. Have Sparks, Picard, McElhinney duel it out however you want.
Well, you can have three goalies in the NHL at one time anyways.
Exactly. So have those three cycle it out in October to deal with the whoever gets the backup role.
Well, with that is, I don't think it's Freddie having a problem with October. I think it's just him having a rough start into like the season. So keeping him out of October means he can probably have like a rough November instead.
Right. But if we have the best of the three backup goalies helping him in November, why not do it? Yes, it's a little asinine not playing Freddie in all of October. It's a whole month.
McElhinney had like a 934 save percentage last season playing only the second of back-to-back games. Let's not try to fix something that isn't broken.
No, I'm not going against McElhinney being bad. McElhinney is an amazing backup goaltender. My only point is he's what, like 36 now, 37? He's only got a few years left. Why are you going to give up a good amount of time with Sparks or even Calvin Picard over a couple of more seasons with McElhinney? Even then, McElhinney might want to leave.
One more season with McElhinney. He's only got one season.
That's what I'm saying. Even with that one season, McElhinney, if he can prove he's a strong goaltender, he might want to get paid. No, he's not going to get paid starter money, but he's going to want to get as much money as possible. At least going to have enough money to pay that.
I think McElhinney's going to be gone after this season for the Leafs. Anyway, I think he's only got one more season. He'll probably retire after that one. I don't think he's looking too much longer after finishing this two-year contract that he signed.
So why would the Leafs trade Sparks then when you can move McElhinney in that 1 year left?
You move Sparks because you don't want to create problems with Freddie, and you can't send him down to the waivers without losing him for nothing. So get something for him now. I mean, he was best goalie in the league last year in the AHL. His stock is high. He's got more room to go down than to go up.
It's AHL high. You're not going to get a second round pick for him. If anything, you'll get like a late third round, but that's like the most you'll get. There's nothing much. Like, I'd rather have him play backup, prove what he's able to do, and get a better return if they end up trading him. That's a big if. I don't see the Leafs trading Sparks. Because right now, you see it's Picard or Pickard. He's the one that's in the trade rumors. It's not Sparks. I feel like Sparks is going to be the backup this year.
And then McElhinney gets sent down?
McElhinney either gets waived or they make a trade with him.
We'll see what Dubas does.
All right. So last question. Cam Watts 25 on Twitter gave us a scenario where Tyler Myers gets traded for Gardner. Personally, just a little bit of background here. They both have 1 year left. Tyler Myers, I believe, is making slightly less than Gardner. I could be wrong, though. Myers is making 5.5, and what's Gardner making?
5.25, right?
Yeah, so he's making slightly more than
5.225, something like that.
He's making 4.05.
Who was I talking? Oh, you know what? I'm thinking about Loophole.
Loophole's gone, man.
I know. I'm
forget about him.
Blast in the past here.
He's not even a defenseman either. Anyways,
so if you were, would you guys do that trade?
No.
Just straight up no?
No.
Nothing to back it up?
No. There's yes, Myers is possibly better defensively, but that being said, Myers had, what, less than like 20 points last year? I'm not going to give away an extra 30 points in Gardner just for a little bit of better defense. Like, even though people are saying the Leafs are not good defensively, Gardner was an above 50% of Corsi 4 percentage. And people like to look at how many giveaways he had, but the best defensemen in the league have the most giveaways. Brent Burns had a lot of giveaways. Drew Doughty had a lot of giveaways. Trying to say that Jake Gardner is not a good defenseman because of his giveaways, that's a confirmation bias. And confirmation bias is where you look for anything to prove your point correct. And trying to use those as points to say that Jake Gardner is not a good defenseman is not true. Gardner is a way better defenseman than most people think. He's able to handle his own. Yes, he had a bad game 7, but he is better than most defensemen in the NHL, and I would prefer Jake Gardner over Tyler Myers 100% of the time.
I think it's a sideways trade, so I wouldn't do it. I'd rather live with the guy that I know.
The devil you know.
The devil I know. I'd rather that.
Well, people are saying it because Gardner's left-handed, Myers is right-handed.
Still not enough. I mean, when you have a Morgan Riley or a Ron Hainsey that can, you know, move back and forth, or I don't think that's a good enough reason to trade them, unless you can do a sign and trade or a trade and sign and get Myers locked up to a deal that's significantly cheaper than what you think you could get Gardner for, then maybe there's some value there. But unless you have a really good understanding of what it would take to re-sign Myers and you're willing to do it, I don't think it's worth the risk. Plus, when Gardner leaves, whenever he does go, I think we're going to be crying, saying we need a puck mover.
Yeah, even like with that, Myers is slow. I don't think he would fit with how the Leafs work. Look at how Polak was, his speed. He couldn't run at the same speed as the rest of the team. I don't think Myers would be able to handle that. But, like, yes, Winnipeg is fast, but I don't think they're as fast as Toronto is or as quick pace. Plus, Myers is playing on the third pairing?
I don't know where he's playing.
Well, wasn't that his big contract issue last year when he was signing the thing? He was behind Truba and, or was it Truba?
I think it was Truba was behind Myers and Buffin. But I'm pretty sure Truba moved up this year. I think Myers got bumped down, and that's another addition to his why he looks so good.
If I'm trading Gardner, I'm getting Truba in return, not Myers. I'm not saying straight up, but.
Well, the problem with that is Truba is a pain in the butt to re-sign. He wants as much money as possible. He looks like he's a cancer, honestly. Yes, he's a good player, but I don't know if I'd be interested in him. Looking at how he acts with all of his contracts. He was saying that, yes, I want to stay in Winnipeg for a long term. I mean, he's asking for more money than he's shown he's, like, what he's able to do.
But Gardner would probably fetch about $7 million. Truba wouldn't be far off from that, and I'd rather give Truba $7 million than Gardner $7 million.
Well, yeah, but I don't think the Leafs can afford Gardner at $7 million regardless.
But can they afford Truba at $7 million?
No, because where's that $7 million?
I think they might be able to afford Truba.
Unless you're getting Truba after Marleau is gone, there's no way to afford that. Even then, you're still going to have Dermott, who's going to need a contract by then.
Kat and Janssen are going to have their contracts by then. You're going to have Lillian Green coming up, and he'll need a contract in a couple years from then.
So the bridge contracts are for him. But you can't always just throw up bridge contracts.
Not how always. We don't. We have really haven't done much of those yet at all.
No, they gave one to Kapanen and Janssen.
I don't know if I'd call those bridge contracts. They're just their second entry level contract, and because they didn't play enough to warrant a full contract.
But again, by the time that they're able to warrant those full contracts, they're going to want their term, their money.
Also, Kapanen did not get a new contract. He's making $860,000 next year.
Yeah, it's just Janssen for 1 year.
Yeah.
Didn't Kapanen get one last year or something?
No, they're both making under 900,000, under eight.
He's on his ELC. Yeah.
Either way, Janssen still got a new contract, and he took some cheap money, less than I thought he should have.
All right, well, I guess that wraps it up for this week. Hopefully we'll be back next week without any technical difficulties. Yeah, if you guys have any questions.
Subscribe to our Twitter at Leafs Plus Pod or Leafs Plus Podcast. I should know
Leafs
this
Plus
right
Pod.
Yeah.
Leafs Plus Pod.
We are on Twitter. SoundCloud, which is what you're probably listening to this on. And if you have an Android, Google Play Music, we are currently on. We're trying to get onto iTunes. There's too many workaround or red tape that we have to go through right now, and their system doesn't load on my computer. So we're gonna keep trying at that. Hopefully, we can get on iTunes because we want to appeal to the iPhone users of the world, like myself. And yeah, let us know what you think. We're always open for suggestions because, again, this is our second full podcast, and we could use the help because I know it, Jay knows it, Michael knows it. And we just want to be the best podcast that we can, and we can't do that without your help. So please let us know. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, whatever you want to do, let us know.
You can take a comment or two if you want.
Yeah, like we'll take any comment at this point just to build it. If you want to say that I was a little too harsh on Michael or Jay needs to speak a little bit louder, whatever it may be, let us know and we'll work on it. All right?
Have yourself. Maybe I got to speak a little less. I think that's probably more realistic.
Well, you know what? We'll hear when the listeners comment. Have yourself a wonderful week, and you'll hear from us soon. Bye.